engage all parties to do that, to look at the legislation. So it's time for us to engage on the legislation because today we would like to pass this legislation. This is the opening. We apologize because we wanted to pass it last week. But the oracles are sorry, only for us part of the launch of both the TNG and the Space in Uganda. So we thought we should give the parties enough time to look at the deal. So we gave last week to the parties. We hope today we are all ready to start with the legislation. Through you, can I allow the department to take action to the legislation? Over to you. I think Mr. Cesar is the head of the department, the legal team to do it. Yeah. Over to you, please.
Thank you. I'm Kwezi Ngwenya. I'm representing the Department of Housing. As honorable members, you know that there were a few changes and also the amendments that came out to the bill. It states that to amend the Housing Consumer Protection Measures Act to ask to amend certain definitions and to define certain ways or expressions, to clarify the scope of application of the said act, to make provision for the late enrollment and a non-declared late enrollment, to enable owners builders to apply for exceptions, to extend claims to include roof leaks, to make further provisions for the use of money in the funds contemplated in the said act, to extend the offences created under the said act, and to amend provisions pertaining to the granting of exceptions and the lodging of appeals, and to provide for further matters connected hereto. If members can have a look at amendment of Section 1 of the Act, Section 1, that is Clause 1, Section 1 of the Act of the Consumer Housing Protection Measures Act, we have proposed, under Clause 1, Subsection B, but a substitution in the definition of the business of a home builder for Paragraph D and the word following that paragraph of the following paragraph. To conduct any other activity that may be prescribed by the minister for the purpose of this definition, but does not include the bona fide building of the home by any person for occupation by that person, the bona fide assistance to the person contemplated in paragraph 1 by a person who is not registered home builder in the building of a home, for the sale or disposal by the housing consumer of his or her bona fide home. Call honorable member to plus 1 subsection C. By the substitution of definition of home builder of the following definition. A home builder means, then we will say, a person who carries on the business of the home builder or an owner builder who has not applied for exception in terms of section 10A. We'll go further to plus one subsection B. By the insertion after the definition of inspector of the following definition, the late enrollment. Will further to say means the submission by a home builder of a request for a particular home to be entered into the record of a council after construction of such a home as stated in contravention of section 40. Then we go to section E, by the insertion after the definition of minister of the following definition, the National Housing Code. Then members will mean the National Housing Code contemplated in section 4 of the Housing Act. And go to option B, any other policy of administration or procedural guideline issued in terms of the Housing Act, which repeals or replaces the National Housing Code. Then go to the F, by the insertion after the definition of the NHRSC technical requirements of the following definition, the non-declared late enrollment. Then honorable members will mean the enrollment where a home builder has not declared the fact that construction of a home has commenced at the time of enrollment and that fact is detected by the council. Then we go to G, by the insertion after the definition of organ of the state of the following definition. Owner's builder means, will then mean or remember a person who builds the home for occupation by himself or herself or a person who is not registered home builder and who assists a person contemplating paragraph A in the building of his or their own home. And go on and remember what is important is that CHP project means a housing project approved in terms of Chapter 8 of Part 3 of the National Housing Code. Housing subsidy scheme and also another people's housing process. Then we go to number 8, by the substitution of paragraph B of the definition of prescribed of the following paragraph. The council, except in section 71.8.1 or 29.1, prescribed in a circular of all registered home builders. Then we'll go to the insertion of section 1 in Act 94/1998. That will be the clause 2. The following section is hereby inserted in the...
Sorry, I thought this is good because I said you know section 1.
Okay.
It will come there.
Thank you, Chairperson. There's just one clause that is intended to be included now, which is right at the bottom of that first page, and it's called TB,
okay,
where it says home builder means an owner builder who has not applied for exemption in terms of section 10A. And I'm looking at some of these late submissions, Chairperson, in that regard. And I need to be corrected if I understand it incorrectly. The implication of this is, although it defines an owner builder under GB, but now says an owner builder who has not applied for exemption becomes a home builder. And from the submissions made by one of the master builders organizations, it means that anybody who starts off building becomes a home builder unless they apply for exemption. And from what I gather here, it puts the onus on the individual to apply for the exemption and become an owner builder, which implies that a lot of people, particularly those that are immigrants, that embark on building their own home without applying for exemption, automatically transgresses the law. And I thought the whole idea of one of these amendments was to make a distinction between the home builder and the owner builder, so that the owner builder doesn't have to comply with this particular legislation. Now, Chair, I want, if from the legal point of view, they can indicate that is the correct understanding as
well.
Madam Chair, from a drafting and a legal viewpoint, that is actually the what I understood the department wanted. The reason, therefore, I think Mr. Quezzi or the image obviously will be better, a better position to explain that.
Thank you very much. Then a person is an owner builder with their person that has been declared owner builder by country. That is the interpretation. Any other person that is not been declared owner builder by country is not a holder. Or might be a holder. So, Chief, by implication, it means anybody, and I'm specifically referring to perhaps segments of our population who are not very literate. Even if they are in the true sense of the word, an owner builder, until they actually apply for exemption, they are not recognized as an owner builder. So the onus is on them to go through a process and ask for exemption. And where the concern lies here is that very many of that particular group of people will not, first of all, not probably not be aware of it, and they, through their ignorance, then transgress the law.
There are a lot of people that through ignorance transgress the law. That's true. But the aim of the law is to bring everybody to book. So which means those who are transgressing the law now shall comply with the law. So by definition, anybody that builds a home must be a registered holder. If you are not registered, you are operating illegally. Mm. And that's why I've set up systems to pick up people that are building houses illegally in the country. The law wants to improve education. Sometimes I've set up some people With the agreement to the banks and government, no person would be granted a home loan unless he uses a registered home loan, unless the property is involved with the NHBRC. Now, those two, I think, are strong enough to ensure that the builder and the housing consumer come to a party and action. Now, if he's using his own finances, again, it's supposed to register with the NHBRC because we are protecting the housing market. So the good part of the legislation is, in the long term, you will have registered buildings come to work. But because the developments are saying it is acceptable for now, that there are still people that like it, that you're bringing to live. But the ideal situation in the country, everybody that is putting bridge and more, except in the rural areas, because those are not yet covered, in terms of what. But the ideal situation, probably after the next rural conference, would be every unit in the rural area needs to be in the record of government. It is a physical code. But we are not yet there. That's one sector. But the builders in those areas, the consumers, the problems, they need a record, and the record will be there. Although they might be using their own money, they are currently supposed to use registered dollars. Although their units are not their own. That's the difference.
Chair only accepted, and obviously I have no problem with home builders. We were talking about owner builders, people that build for themselves, maybe even with their own money. Like I said, the onus is then on them to apply for exemption. But the problem is, and perhaps here NHBRC should then intensify the educational program, because particularly where there are groupings of people that are by nature illiterate, they should emphasize that if you're going to do this, if you're doing it for yourself,
sure.
Otherwise they're not going to apply for exemption, they're then guilty.
And I think what you're saying is part and parcel of consumer education,
yes.
So that people
out there
are aware of the consequences.
Yes.
Is that? Yeah, just to check then. In terms of the NHBRC's own statement, how many people are there out there? Do they have any idea how many people have not registered? Because if it is so that they are, and then by acknowledgement of the NHBRC, there now are a lot of people who may not be registered, who may not be aware. Do they have any idea how many what that figure could be? And have they, would they give any consideration, maybe, I don't know, to maybe some, during a certain period, to say that by such and such a day, all must be registered, and thereafter, this is what would happen.
Just as
we have
statistics on the ones that we catch. We are looking at currently about 11,000 registered home loaners on the database. I'm not having exact figures of the people that we found this current financial year, but those figures can be provided. We do catch some of those. We do catch them, but I'm not having the statistics for now. I only have the statistics of the current database.
Mr.
Daniel?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. I just also want to talk about this bonus builder, because apparently the way I understand it, this bonus builder is a person who has his own money and who wants to build a house for himself. And sometimes we are talking about he should be registered, but we are not saying, you know, he's going to use his own material, whatever, what type of material he's using. Are we just going to worry about the guy who just registered, whether what type of material is he using?
Thank you,
Chair. On the same point, I don't know whether this question should go to the council or the department. Because here the aim is to try and protect the consumer. What do we envisage the role? of your building inspector. Because even if I build with my own money, using my own experience, I mean my own material, I have to go and apply to the municipality, to the given municipality, submit my plans, and so forth. Then, before they give permission for me to build, I think there must be some condition with this to say, before you go on, are you registered before you build this in this area? So that it's also in the interest of the municipality that they must have how this built by a registered builder, whether own building or somebody else. Where in the act, or there are there any other acts that are making sure that this one would be able to operate with them at that level? Because I think that would then alleviate the concerns of this thing.
The issue of materials is picked up on time. All SADS materials should be utilized, or SADS approved materials should be utilized. But we all know that sometimes in hidden corners you might get raw material on site. And if you pick up raw material on site, you disqualify it. So it's not only registration. The fact that you are registered as a home builder, you get a manual. And that manual prescribes. If you're not going through the manual, you then have to go through an agreement certification. Or you need to go through a rational design. Also approved by the NABRC, explaining how you need to go about with your construction. The inspection service, yes, is a free service once the property is endorsed, which means your housing consumer and your home builder have free access. They can call upon an inspector to be on site. The point that you are raising is the built environment side, where in some countries, of course, the LABRC or HBC in London in particular approved plan. But we have not moved to that level. That is the build control environment. Cancer is investigating the possibility, where it will work in tandem with municipality, where LABRC will be a substitute. It's quite an involved process because part of the current, some of the series of legislation will have to be amended. It's something we're considering. But there is an agreement between the municipalities and us that all approved plans will be submitted to the NABRC. But the actual approval is still done by the municipality. But we want to have greater control on the built environment. We are still investigating that process. And what legislation needs to be amended to have one inspection service to make sure that all approved plans also bear the NABRC. So that is work in progress. We will not just change the legislation by investigating that part of the
world. With that explanation, can we move from code 1 to this is not people who have problems in terms of that?
Okay.
Yes, yes. How much is it? Great follow up question.
I just asked that it's a follow up question on this particular point. I think that Honorable Blamey raised an interesting point about that. It wasn't really warranted, I don't think. The point that he raised was that when a municipality approves the plan, at the same time that I submit the plan to build a house, I must also submit proof that the builder I am going to use, whether it's me or Mr. Tlamini, I must submit proof that that person is registered and that the municipality would not approve those plans unless there is written proof from me that I am using the registered builder. Is that in place? And could that not be put in place through regulations or something?
It is not yet in place. That relates to what I'm saying is being investigated. Approval of the plan themselves. Should the process involve an NABRC stamp before, or should they get an NABRC stamp after approval, before construction starts? The issue that you are raising about the housing consumer submitting a plan and submitting the name of the builder, those are the things that we're investigating. that they may do. We want to see how best can we ensure that we amend municipal legislation to comply with any legislation. That has not been done. That's what I'm saying, under investigation. And I call it the whole control building environment. That's what we're investigating. A number of options, including approval of them. Because not been finalized, the means is that we are considered to give a full answer. We have not taken a decision. We have not determined the fees that we have to be paid. We are saying, let's investigate it first, so that we can know what to amend.
Church members in taking their process forward, they just need to know to themselves. And the matter that they say is after the investigation. It's the same.
No, Chair, as I said, if we could sort of make a note, and then obviously yeah. Consumer education needs
yes.
to go along with it.
Sure.
Okay. And then I'll pass on this
question. Could I allow you, if I
can
go to the second
cross,
please? Thank
you, Minister. Madam Chair, we'll go now to the second clause, which will deal with the insertion of Section 1 in the following section is here but inserted in the Principal Act after Section 1. And it reads that Section A, Subsection 1, this Act applies to any home builder. Section 2, this Act does not apply to a person who uses his or her own labor to build a home for his or her own occupation if the home is part of an approved PHP project. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Then we go to clause 3.
Yeah.
Clause 3 will deal with the amendment of Section 7 of the Act of 1995 as amended by Section 1. Section 7 of the Application Act is hereby amended. A. By the substitution in subsection 1A for subparagraph 3 and 4 of the following subparagraphs, respectively. Prescribing enrollment fees and late enrollment fees, including method of calculating such fees, in respect of homes or categories of homes or other fees, excluding the fees contemplated in subsection 2. And 4, prescribing procedures for enrollment, late enrollment, non-declared late enrollment, and cancellation of enrollment. And B, by insertion subsection 1A was a paragraph 4 of the following subparagraph. Governing the application of NHBRC technical requirements to home financed by state housing subsidy. C. By substitution in subsection 2 for paragraph E of the following paragraph. And E. The minimum and maximum amount which may be expended under section 17(1) in respect of any home pursuant to the failure of a home builder to meet his or her obligation in terms of Section 13(2)(b)(i). For the purpose of Section 17(1), the Minister may prescribe which cost may be included in a claim and which cost may not be included in a claim. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let's start by thinking about the each of every one of this. Be with A first before you go to B or C. It's fine. All of it is fine.
Yes.
Clause 2. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. That clause 4 will then deal with the insertion of section 10A in section 5. The following section is hereby inserted in the Principal Act after section 10. Owner-builder exception. Section 10A reads that an owner-builder may, in terms of section 29, apply to the council for exception from section 10 and 14. I'll allow the members to be read.
Are you fine with that?
I hope you're fine.
Let me just warn you. If you say I must pass, I'm going to do that. Once you have passed, you have passed.
So okay,
if I wanted to go slower,
blah, blah.
Okay.
Please don't remember that. Thank you. We go to clause 5, which deals with amendment of section 14 of the Act, as amended by section 2 of Act 27. Section 5, then clause 5, will deal with section 14 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution in subsection 2 for the words preceding paragraph A of the following words. The home builder shall not commence the construction of the home, the acquisition of which, except in respect of any deposit payable, will be financed solely from the proceeds of the state housing subsidy. And another one, not in paper. Yes. We're going to insertion of section 14A in X, that will be clause 6. The following section is here inserted in the principal act of section 14. The late enrollment and non-declaration, non-declared late enrollment. Section 14A, 1, where a home builder, A, in contravention of section 14, submits an application for enrollment of a home to the council after construction has started, or B, does not declare the fact that construction has commenced at the time of enrollment and the council becomes aware of that. The council shall require the home builder to certify the council that the construction undertaken at the time is in accordance with the NHBRC technical requirement and shall take prudent measures contemplated in section 16(1) to manage the risk pertaining to the fund. And 2, in case of late enrollment and non-declared late enrollment, the home builder shall, then A, submit to the council such documentation and information as may be prescribed in the council's rules. B, at the request of the council, pay a prescribed late enrollment fee in an amount determined by the council for a special inspection to be undertaken by the council to enable the inspector to determine compliance with NHBRC technical requirements prior to the acceptance of enrollment. C, at the request of the council and prior to the acceptance of the enrollment, rectify any defect detected during the inspection contemplated in paragraph B. That any influence the structural integrity of the home or that constitute non-compliance with the NHBRC technical requirement. At the home builder's cost and under supervision of a competent person appointed by the home builder, D, at the request of the council, in circumstances where an inspector is unable to determine compliance with the NHBRC technical requirements, for whatever reason, appoint a competent person. I, to inspect the home and to complete a late enrollment report in the form prescribed in the council's rule to confirm compliance with the NHBRC technical requirements. Then E, member, undertake any work and pay for any cost resulting from such work to expose work already done in order to enable the competent person to address all questions raised in the late enrollment report contemplated in paragraph G, in ordinal figure 2, and F, of the member, at the request of the council, provide any security guarantee, indemnity, or other security considered reasonable by the council to satisfy its obligations under section 16(1). And clause 3, notwithstanding the provisions of this section, the council may prescribe disciplinary measures for late enrollment and non-declare late enrollment which are not inconsistent with the Act.
Just to comment, I agree with everything here because I believe this is where the risk for NHBRC is probably the greatest.
Yes.
And the sort of concern that I've got here is that, I mean, we're trying to cover all the possibilities that they go back and get people to expose work already done. But I want to make a plea to the NHBRC that they pay particular attention to this. And make any other recommendations that would make it even stronger in terms of guaranteeing against rectification later on for NHBRC to limit their risk.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
But just the other thing that I just see we're saying that number 2, Roman Street at 2, I just want to Roman Street at 2. And the room is at 4. How are we going to make sure that the room is like on a fee for the court if it has to be rectified? And what do we do if it doesn't pay the court?
Then
I think
we are seeing one interest in supervising that court. So, what you are saying here is that NHBRC will not be liable. So, NHBRC is only liable when the company is
registered.
So, this is a late enrollment. Before we enroll it, we are saying there are costs. This cost could be cost to the housing consumer, and there could be cost to the seller. But in this instance, the seller is liable. So, here what we're talking about is very exact. By a registered builder or by an unregistered builder who decides to ignore the law and build. Now we're saying before you can bring the risk to the NHBRC, there are a few things that need to be clear. And you must pay this as penalty for a few things before an ordinary day.
Yes, I just want to know, I understand what you say. What are the actions in case he doesn't comply, he doesn't pay the cost?
The home will not be enrolled. It's a late enrollment. Unless you pay to rectify, we will not enroll. The section says late enrollment and non-declared late enrollment. Now, the challenge here is, where is the complaint coming from? Is it from the bank to say, no, we will not grant the loan? If the bank says to us, we are not granting a loan, then that person will not get a loan. But if it's a circumstance where it's a cash builder, and the cash builder realizes that at some point he wants to sell the unit, say you have a million investment. That. Because you want the unit to be sold, you need an NHBRC. Then again, you'll come and say, I want to enroll the unit. If it's one unit, we say yes, we're prepared to assist the housing consumer. You have decided to construct. In order to protect our new consumers, they bear the following. Rectify, we will consider one a short insurance to protect the money.
Let's move to button 67.
Okay. I think you're chairman, I'm not number. Section 16 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution for subsection 6 of the following subsection. And 6 will read thus: if at any time the fund of the council appears insufficient to meet anticipated demands, the council may, on the recommendations of the fund advisory committee, after the procedures referred to in section 17, 3, 4, and 5, with the necessary changes required by the context have been followed, increase the fees payable by home builders and MEC in respect of the enrollment of homes contemplated in section 14 and 14A, respectively.
Yes.
Let's
go then to
8. Thank you, Madam Chair. Because 8, section 17 of the Principal Act is hereby amended, and A, by the substitution in subsection 1 for paragraph A of the following paragraph. A, within, number 1, 5 years of the date of occupation, a major structural defect has manifested itself in respect of a home as a result of non-compliance with the NHBRC technical requirements, and the home builder has been notified accordingly within that period. And 2, 12 months of the date of occupation, a roof leak attributable to workmanship, design and material has manifested itself in respect of a home, and the home builder has been notified accordingly within that period. And B, by the substitution of subsection 2 of the following subsection, 2, subject to subsection 3, 4, and 5, if money is not payable, or, if the money is not available, or is expected not to be available for that purpose due to future demand on the fund, the council may reduce any amount. A, subject to section 7.2e, reduce any amount on the line that may be expended in terms of subsection 1. And B, in exceptional circumstances, instead of having a defect rectified, make payments to the housing consumer in full and final settlement of any claim. Or C, refuse any claim, and C, by substitution in subsection 5 of paragraph B of the following paragraph, prescribe increased enrollment fee or late enrollment fee under section 16(6). Thank you, Chair.
This is where I have a big problem, and although essentially much of this is in the original bill, it leaves a bit of a bitter taste in my mouth. Because, and particularly when it says that if NHPRC, if there's no money available, or they expect that there won't be money available in the future. I mean, it's almost like you're taking out insurance on your vehicle, and then when you want to claim, they say, sorry, we don't have any money to pay. This, as far as I'm concerned, if an entity doesn't have money, then they're not a going concern. And they, therefore, they shouldn't, because they can then continue to enroll houses, take the money, knowing full well that they actually don't have money to pay off claims. And to me, that is fraud, or it's equal to fraud. So, I don't mind that they can determine how much to pay, that they can reduce the amount under certain circumstances, but in terms of if money is not available or is expected not to be available, that I think should come out of this bill. If you expect that there's not going to be any money, you're not a going concern.
The cost of construction. Now, under such exceptional circumstances, the NSPRC goes on strike, it removes the community, it pays the full value of the unit at that time, because it's an exceptional circumstance. For NSPRC to rebuild the house, the question is very high. A 500,000 house could cost 20 million because you're building on an old quarry. Now, we are saying under those circumstances, we need to pay a full settlement. How is housing consumer protected? It doesn't have a debt. The house has been paid off. Where housing consumers already paid for at least 3 years, there is a benefit because there would be some residue from the payment of their money. Those are the type of exceptional circumstances that we have done for housing. And in that way, we believe that housing consumer is better protected. That brings a new cost to the fund.
Yeah, I fully agree with what has been said as well. I think the exceptional circumstances should be kept. The clause that allows them to reduce the amount should be kept. But what I have a problem with is the fact that if they have no money, the CEO has indicated that they know a year in advance, they'll come to Parliament, they'll ask for money. Then why put it in the bill? We're giving them an open back door to be telling them, they're saying here that if they don't have money or they think they won't have money, they can then refuse anything.
Understanding as to whether there has been, whether the NHPRC has used it The question I want to ask is, has this happened yet? And number two, if the NHGRC wants to reduce its payments of claims based on the fact that they may not be sufficient funds, that's what it was saying, who does the NHGRC have to get permission from? Do they just do it on their own accord, or do they need to seek permission from the minister or from the board? What happens? Can we get clarity on that? Because I think that should be an important point. Thanks, Shane.
Can I
just explain
the
NHGRC?
Yeah. Jay, obviously I've got a somewhat different view on it from the problem that I have here is that this takes away the responsibility, quite honestly, from NHGRC to see that they do their job properly. Because if the risks increase and if the claims increase, it could be due to the fact that the inspectors are in fact not doing their work. But it puts the consumer at a disadvantage. Because their risks have increased and their claims have increased, they can now make a decision and say they can reduce your claim, a very legitimate claim, or they can refuse it altogether. Simply based on the fact that they do not have or anticipate not to have funds. Now, if it's true that NHGRC can come back to Parliament a year in advance, then my question once again, and I'm not disputing the fact, I said in my opening remarks, it's kept in the original bill, they're just making some amendments. Why do we need it in the bill at all?
My only problem is saying, if this was in the original deal, why do we have a problem today? If all along the
well, if I can answer your
question. If it has been there all along and it has never been abused, why do we think today this matter could be abused?
My answer is, first of all, I wasn't part of the committee that said the original bill. But there is an amendment before us. It doesn't mean that we can't amend something that is in the bill. That may have slipped through the cracks and that could be to the disadvantage of the consumer.
Is that because
you're
losing,
sorry,
that's because now you're
beginning
to
lose faith in the answer. Yes, sir.
Okay.
Chair, I've just been reading the original bill here.
Yeah.
And in the original bill, under page 28 of the original bill, under section 17, subsection 3, I just want to get clarity. Bill subsection 3, 4, 5 remain in the bill. These amendments that are being made here. Is it removing those or those remaining? Because if those are remaining, then I think there's no problem. Because when you read here, subsection 3 says, prior to exercising its powers in terms of subsection 2, council shall consult with and make recommendations to the minister in respect of its obligations under section 16.1 and 16.4. The minister shall make a decision on any recommendation contemplating subsection 3 within a period of 3 months. 5. The council may not A. exercise its powers in terms of subsection 2 or prescribe increased enrollment fees under section 16.6 unless the minister has approved such action or the period referred to in subsection 4 has expired. So I think that is safety. So the NHGRC doesn't have free reign there. This is what it wants. That's the permission of the minister. Thank you.
Maybe
you
have to
I'm also going to read that. Now, the members are also going to read the Act, section 38. It says that any time the funds of council appear insufficient to meet anticipated demand, therefore the Act says, the Council may, on the recommendation of the Funds Advisory Committee, and after the procedure referred to in subsection 17.345, with the necessary changes required by the context have been followed, increase the fees. Well, I'm reading section 17 subsection 6 of the Act. The fund of council appears insufficient to meet the anticipated demand. The council may, on the recommendation of the fund advisor, request, and after the procedure referred to in section 17.3.4.5, that's what I think it has been read. With the necessary changes required by the contract have been followed, increase the fees payable by the homeholder and probation to be held in fees in respect of enrollment contemplated in section 14. So there is a process. So I think the honorable member is right to say, if you read this section, subsection 6 or 16, and you read the section 17 that you have read, there is sufficient protection. Now, I'm not sure if it comes in to the actual concern here. If money is not available, it doesn't substitute what is in the Act. It says, subject to the same subsection, if money is not available, after all that process has been followed, everything has been met, then it's expected not to be available for the purposes of due to the future demand, then cancel me. There is a process. You have first to consult with the minister. You need first to say, are fees available? And it's only after that process that we can take that decision. I think that is how the protection is in the. I'm not sure if I'm clear. The section that one of the minister members just read, that process needs to be followed before this decision can be taken. So the purpose of this section is to further clarify the section. I think it's clear right now.
To live
in that context.
Okay. Just lastly, I accept that there are these clauses that where they can get more money. I accept that there's a process that they have to go to the minister. But with respect to this, the minister is only human. And she would probably nine times out of ten go along with the recommendation from NHPRC. And we cannot use the fact that they have to go through that process as an excuse that there is a safeguard. The fact of the matter is that the safeguard here is that should there not be any funds, they can refuse on those grounds. Now, where do you get a warranty system that says, I will take your money and I will give you a 5-year warranty, but if I don't have money, then I'm not going to pay you, but I'm going to carry on with my business as usual. Then it's what objection is there to deleting the sentence about if there's no money available or if there's expected not to be money available in view of the fact that has been indicated there are various ways where they can raise the money.
Now,
with
the substitute in your view be that the minister pays or reserves the money? Because the minister in the sense would have also realized, this committee would have also realized there are no sufficient funds. And we'll have to come to the committee and say, we need a vote, we need money from government to pay for those people. In the end, if NHBRC pays the liabilities with government, government will have to pay those debts. That is, that's an argument in terms of the safeguard. If for NHBRC tomorrow they're closed, all the liabilities government has to go and rectify. The people can have a claim against the state because you are doing it on behalf of the state.
Chair, if that is the case, why do we need a clause that says if they don't get the money, they will refuse to pay? That is my question. If the safeguards are all there, then ultimately somebody is going to pay. Why do we specifically need in the law that if they don't get money or if they foresee that they won't get money, that they can refuse? Then it's obsolete. We may as well take it out. Because from what the CEO has said, somebody will eventually pay. They'll have a claim not against NHBRC, against government. But then why is this, and I repeat my word, this backdoor for NHBRC to refuse a claim?
No, you know what? I was thinking, because it is in the principal act, many people were talking about, is really the need of amendment. If it's covered in the case, then what is it that you want to rectify today?
Can you go to on the issue of exceptional circumstances, that it must be defined in the regulation.
So the regulations must define the circumstances.
Yes.
Thank you. And then we go to clause 9.
Madam Chair, just on the last amendment, the exceptional circumstances must actually be prescribed in the regulation. So, can we draft it according to the Act? I think there's a definition of prescribed, so we can just say in prescribed exceptional circumstances. So, we don't have to use the exact words that was.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam General Member. We are now at clause number 9. We read that section 21 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the substitution in subsection 1 for paragraph B of the following paragraph. Then B contravenes open bracket a provision of close bracket section 10 subsection 1 or 2 or 13.7 or 14.1 or 2 or 18.1 or 2 or 19.5. Thank you, Chair. And now at clause 10 on our members, it reads that section 22 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the addition of the following subsection. And 5, notwithstanding subsection 1 to 4, any person who feel aggrieved by any decision that the Council has made in terms of section 29 may, within 1 month from the date on which that decision was made known by the Council, lodge an appeal in writing with the Minister against the decision, and thereupon the Minister may confirm, set aside, or amend such decision of the Council.
Actually, one doesn't have a problem with
concerns here that I raised at the previous meeting. One is that, and it goes along with what Greg said about the information getting to the person involved. And the way it is said there, we must remember we're dealing with legislation. It says on which such decision was made known by the council. It's not very specific that it must be made known to the agreed individual. The council can put out a statement based on a decision, and so I would want to see some sort of amendment there. Was made known by the council to the either the agreed person or the affected party or something like that. So that the onus is that they must get in touch with the individual. And then secondly, I raised the question about the time frame again. There's a time frame to lodge the appeal. There's no time frame for the minister to reach a decision. And I would ask that we look at the time frame equally, because these things can take up to a year. That there should be some sort of reasonable time frame within which a decision with regard to the appeal should be made. Thank you.
I also agree with the amendment to 2 months, and also the same proposal. I'm just talking about the minister may confirm, set aside, amend. He may also choose not to do anything.
Minister may confirm. Any questions? And the department takes into account the concern in terms of informing the consumer.
The first one, any person who shows a grief by any division of council, that is the management of section 29, that is about exemption. Now, under section 29, there is a clause that says council shall reach and make known a decision within 60 days of receipt of an application made. That is subsection 2 of section 29. Now, I'm not sure if that is sufficient or it's not sufficient. In terms of time frame. Now, with regard to the minister may, and the minister shall, or the minister will, or may, I think that it is then that I'm not sure what in the country, but that I think can be amended. And that legal has a challenge with it, in terms of protocol, I'm not sure certain.
Shall. In terms of what you suggested to be included in terms of the consumer, NFRC says at the bottom there, clause 2 of 29 states exactly that. It is an assumption, therefore, that this person for a good party would have been informed. Is that okay?
Let's refer to, obviously, I would imagine, the initial decision. Mm-hmm. And with respect, I don't think it applies only to exemption. I mean, if we look at the earlier clause where they may reduce an amount, the same thing would apply here. If somebody is aggrieved there based on that decision, not necessarily just exemption. So yes, it says they will make their decision within 60 days. But it still doesn't address the fact that the minister, whether she may, shall, or must now come back, or shall come back within, again, 60 days or 90 days or something to the effect. That is what I want to add.
Okay. 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 Okay
determined in regulation. So I think what Greg has said already on section, on section 22, I think for 2 months, it covers the whole thing. Why should we try and complicate the whole thing?
Greg pulled by saying, after the first development, I don't think about any of your
And she asked, you know, ask that what's the same Lord Vata here? Is it not possible just to get an indication? I mean, in other pieces of legislation, you know, any other legislation where there are appeals made and then there's a decision being read to the minister, in other pieces of legislation, is it determined in the legislation the time period within which the minister must make a decision, or is it determined in regulation? How is it affected in other pieces of legislation? That would then help us, yeah.
Okay. Before I do the statement of
my
wait for me. Okay, how about you, sir?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was a little afraid of this question. It's not unusual in our legislation to oblige a political official of a bearer to make a decision within a certain time. The Constitutional Court somewhere, I can't remember the case, refers to that these are elected people and they it's not, I can't remember the words, but what usually happens is that the minister has a reasonable time. And the reasonable time has been defined by the courts in cases. It will usually be on a case-by-case basis because it will depend on a lot of circumstances. So the consumer or the applicant here has the right after a reasonable time to then approach court if the minister doesn't apply with it. In a few cases, they have put in time frames, I've seen, but it's not the usual that we don't do that usually.
So we can't do
an exception there. Would you say here then? Yes, sir, yes. And then can we not then put in within a reasonable time frame?
Yes, we can make
that. So you say the minister
shall consent within a reasonable
time. Something like that. At the end of the day.
You appeal to the council or to the minister?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Honourable Member, now we're at clause 11, when it says the following section is hereby substituted for section 29 of the Principal Act. The exemption, that will be 29.1, the minister, open bracket, minister, open bracket, council may, open bracket, on the recommendations of the council, close bracket, on application made to it in the format prescribed by the council by notice in the Gazette, in exceptional circumstances, and on the conditions that the minister may, open bracket, determine, close bracket, prescribe in general or in any particular case, comma, exempt a person from home from any provisions in this act if the minister, open by minister, open by the council, certifies that A, the granting of the exemption will be in the public interest, B, the granting of the exemption will not undermine the objectives of this act or the effectiveness of the council, or C, should the exemption not be granted, the effect will be extremely prejudicial to the interest of the applicant and housing consumer. Two, the council shall reach and make known a decision within 60 days of receipt of an application made to it. And three, an exemption contemplated in subsection 1 is not therefore transferable.
Just for clarity and order that the amendments are not wrong, the amendment in clause 8, the prescribed, in terms of the act, when the minister prescribed a regulation in the Gazette, the definition of prescribed in clause 1, up in section 1, and if it's the council, it's prescribed by circular. In this instance, are we referring to a prescribed by the minister or by the council? Clause 8, where we say in prescribed exceptional circumstances, should we say prescribed by the council or by the minister?
Oh, okay.
Prescribed by the council.
Okay, sure. members, we are getting now to the formal part of the discussion. May I smuggle in something to say, saying that given that we have given in on the issue we're worried about, that this legislation is not considered. Okay. Motion of disability. Can we put it before the committee that in the opinion of the committee, legislation is desirable to amend the Housing and Innovative Measures Act 1998, so as to amend certain conditions and to define the new expression and to provide for mental and benefits therewith. Do you agree with that?
Agreed.
So I will take it as a unanimous decision of the committee.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no voting
necessary. What's our amendment?
With the amendment, of course, it's all the amendments that are taken. Okay. All right. Any other matter? Can you agree that this is being passed by unanimous vote of the committee? Yes. Thank you. Oh, we're going closer to the members. I don't think we should go closer because of the
Thank you.